Hey guys, Dirt here, and welcome to another podcast here on ineatcomics.com, part of the Pop Culture Network. In just a few minutes, I will be on the line with Stuart Paul. He's the writer of the new Wildstorm title, The Ides of Blood. The Ides of Blood is an interesting alternate history take, asking the question, what if Julius Caesar had conquered Transylvania and brought vampires back to be slaves for the Roman Empire? Stuart and I are going to talk a little bit about comics, talk about his screenwriting background, talk a little bit about Star Trek, everything in there. So sit back, relax, guys, and I hope you enjoy the interview. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, now I am on the line with Stuart Paul, writer of Ides of Blood for Wildstorm, imprint of DC, and thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this book is from Wildstorm, which is, like I just said, part of DC Comics, and the solicitations, the press that they've sent out for it, they all say that this is True Blood meets Rome. Would you say that's the fairest way to describe it?
It's certainly the perhaps the clearest. I don't know if it's the most accurate.
Well, that's like the Hollywood thing that they do, right? They take two things and they kind of say, "Oh, it's this plus this."
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a good shorthand for kind of giving people the idea, but also, obviously, those are two very recent creations, and so it's sort of like people tend to not have long memories, whereas there are other, you know, comparisons that are, you know, could be just as valid, whether it's, you know, you're talking about Spartacus instead of Rome, or Gladiator. I mean, as far as the vampire aspect of it goes, I mean, True Blood's a fair enough assessment, I suppose. Because, I mean, there isn't that much good vampire stuff to compare it to.
Right.
And if you bring up Dracula, that kind of gives you this sort of, like, gothic baggage.
Right.
And sort of, there's been so many bad Dracula things that, I mean, I'm glad they didn't do that. The point is, it's definitely gives you the right idea, but also, you know, it's just, there's such current comparisons that I think anytime you go blank meets blank, you kind of are shortchanging something in some way.
Well, and it's also, I think, fair to say that it's not like you saw Rome and you watched True Blood and you thought, oh, I need to mix these two shows together.
Right. No, I mean, I'm a fan of both, especially Rome. I think it's one of the best shows of the decade. But, I mean, this idea started up before I was aware of either of them or either of them came into existence. Although I'm sure the Sookie Stackhouse books were probably around, but I hadn't heard of them. I don't think most people had when I was originally figuring all this out.
So where does the inspiration come from? I mean, at what point do you sit down and say, you know, I really need to do a story with Julius Caesar and vampires?
That was really just, that moment comes out of boredom, I guess. it was kind of a random thing. I was just, thinking about, stories I wanted to tell for comics, and I thought about vampires simply because they're a genre staple. And, you know, I was like, okay, do I have anything to say about vampires? And I was initially just kind of like, no, vampires kind of bore me. I have never, like, really been in love with any vampire tales per se.
Right.
I mean, there are some that I've found a couple that I do genuinely think are great. But generally speaking, I've never really liked anything in the subgenre. So it was just a sort of challenge to myself. What would I have to do to make vampires interesting to me again? And Julius Caesar and Rome popped into my head.
Well, I was going to say, when you were talking about how not a lot of vampire stuff you know, really appeals to you. That's kind of been my feeling as well. And I think the one thing, when I think about vampires, especially for, you know, my generation growing up in the 80s, is The Lost Boys. And it's that idea that it's a vampire story, but it's not really, you don't go into the movie saying, I'm going to watch a movie about vampires. It's a movie about teenagers. It's a movie about, you know, it's kind of a coming of age tale that happens to have blood sucking in it. And that's one thing I kind of felt when I was reading through this. It didn't feel like I was reading just, you know, vampires are, they go in cycles, you know, every 7 or 8 years, mm-hmm. it seems like there's something big having to do with vampires that grabs everyone's attention and it's hot. You know, it's Anne Rice novels or it's the Hammer horror films mm-hmm. or something. And this didn't feel like it was necessarily trying to cash in on a trend. It's, there are vampires in it, but it's not trying to ape anything else that I'm really seeing or reading or hearing about out there.
I appreciate that. I'm glad that's how it felt, because I was definitely concerned that people would just assume it was trying to cash in on vampires for, you know, this 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes in time right now being hot per se.
Right.
Even though I think, I mean, once you start to, yeah, indeed, like once you start to ape the genre, and you start to make fun of it, you can tell that the trend is sort of going out of style. I think that's pretty much where we are now. But I think we sort of got this in there under the deadline. Well, there was still some time left on the vampire lifespan. But even aside from that, I mean, I never thought of it in terms of the market. It was just vampires are one of many genres, and this seems like a really fun story. And I wanted to put them together and see what would happen when you mixed sword and sandals with this you know, supernatural horror.
Now, you did come from a screenwriter background, is that correct?
Yeah, that's. I went to USC and graduated from their screenwriting program. And, you know, I've been knocking around Hollywood doing the young writer thing, you know, minor successes, lots of close calls, many heartbreaks, and then through a fortuitous series of events, came into contact with DC's film division and ended up telling them about Ides of Blood, as a script that I had written that I always thought would make a great graphic novel. And they agreed and sort of championed it and sent it over to Wildstorm. Well, not the script. I rewrote the pitch for comics specifically, and they sent it over, and that's how it all got started.
So it was...
And it's really been... I was just going to say, it's been a pleasure discovering... the medium of comics.
I was going to say, because it did start as something, are you saying that it did start as something different, as like a screenplay perhaps, that then you decided to transfer over to the comic page?
That's correct, yeah.
So what kind of challenges did you find in transferring it from one to the other?
Well, let's see.
I mean, did you have to do some major changes with the pacing, since you were going from, you know, one long, basically uncut story into breaking it into chunks, into these different, you know, chapters per se for the different issues? Was that kind of a headache you had to deal with, or did that seem to just kind of fall out on its own?
Not really, because generally, you know, screenwriting structure, you want to have a major turning point every 15 pages. And if you have, I guess you'd have 8 turning points generally if you have like a full 120-page script. But, you know, if you whittle that down and you have six turning points, you know, that's your six issues. So the structure itself kind of lended itself to comics in that respect. But the story definitely changed in that it took on more of a pulpy kind of noir feel when it went to comics. But really, it's kind of difficult to say because it's not a strict, it's not a literal adaptation of the screenplay. A lot just changed as far as, you know, I got to sort of start over again. Mm-hmm. So anytime you're going to, you know, I can always look at something and wish I had done things differently. So the fact was I kind of got to start over again and tell the story a little differently. That's kind of, I mean, it was kind of the nice thing is like, if you're dealing with a story that you are telling in two mediums, it's a terrible thing to be developing them at the same time. However, it does sort of allow you to, if you were sort of wobbling between two choices in the story, like, okay, do I go this way or do I go that way? You can kind of be like, well, I can go this way in the film and I can go this way in the comic. So it kind of lets you have your cake and eat it too in that respect. But the biggest thing was just also comics let me get away with things that you wouldn't be able to get away with in a film necessarily. There's a bit of extravagance and just kind of cool stuff or a little bit more obscure references or other things like that, but I think comic readers are much more attuned to and appreciate and will go with that. I don't know if it's film goers or it's studios or it's both, but whatever the case, you can't really get away with that for screenplays.
Yeah, and also I think sometimes when you're able to write those references down where someone can read it and see it and pause and think about it, as opposed to where it's on a screen and it's just kind of flying by and you either catch it or you don't and it's here and it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, I think that kind of changes things. But also, I was going to say, there's a scene, at the beginning where we have the opening murder and the vampires come to attack and I don't want to say they're over the top necessarily, but they do have, you know, kind of costumes on. They're making a scene out of it. They're definitely trying to scare the guy. And it almost seems like something where you can draw it on the page and kind of leave certain aspects of it to the imagination as you go from panel to panel, how things are going to flow. Whereas if you had to do that as a movie, it might seem a little more, hokey. It might seem a little more staged when you see actors moving through it as opposed to when you have it on the page and your mind is kind of filling in the blanks of how things are playing out for these characters.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot it's more true in novels, especially like Stephen King, I think, is the best example where you read him on the page and even though he can still, even on the page, sometimes some of the characters are a little hokey. For the most part, you know, you really buy into what's happening, but if you put those on screen exactly as he wrote them, it really just does not play. Like I just watched Maximum Overdrive. His infamous.
The massive trucks.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know what? This really is exactly what he wanted to say, I think. Like, this is how this is his stories and his characters. And there's a reason that The Shining is so amazing. And it's like when a great filmmaker took, you know, that and transferred it into this other medium, it worked, but certain things they don't translate perfectly to the visual medium. And so there's different ways of writing for each one. So anyway, I think,
well, now that you've done that adaption yourself, now that you've taken something that you had for one medium and moved it to a different medium, do you have a different appreciation for people who have to do that? Like, especially maybe someone who wants to make a movie and the studio might say, okay, well, here's this book, turn this book into a movie. And now they have to turn it from one thing into a different thing, but try to keep it the same to make everybody happy. Do you have a different appreciation now for people who have to deal with those types of situations now that you've done it?
Well, I mean, I have been on that that side where I took someone else's story and I had to try to honor it. But I've also, done that myself a couple of times. And really, I think it's easier to do if it's not your source material, because you can be a lot more brutal with it.
It's easier to cut things out and just let it go as opposed to, I really like this, I have to keep all this stuff in here.
Exactly. So that's kind of part of it. But, yeah, it's definitely tricky to know what to honor and what to keep and what just isn't important sometimes. But basically, you just have to focus in on what is the core of the movie, what is the story that I'm telling. And then the differences should hopefully become apparent.
Now, looking at some of the other stuff you did Orion Save Girls Must Die.
I wrote that, yeah.
I was just going to ask, are you a big Star Trek fan? Is that what led you to that one?
Absolutely. Star Trek is the most important piece of entertainment, culture, writing, pop culture, storytelling, that I have experienced, like to my development as a writer or just to my existence. I was the kid that in junior high, I would like make my own Star Trek shirt. Like, I was so excited about First Contact coming out, and like, I freaked out when I saw they had new uniforms.
Right, right. Well, how'd you feel about the new movie that they just did?
I was actually insanely impressed just because what they were trying to do should not have worked. It really, by all rights, should have completely failed. And I thought they pulled it off really well. It's the perfect example of what I was just talking about with adaptation. They were just, it just happens that what they were adapting was this entire 30-year, megalithic empire of science fiction. And they had to sort of reinterpret it. But the amazing thing is that, they found this nice little way to, kind of honor canon and completely change everything.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love the fact that once I realized that there was a connection to the original storyline, like once I realized that everything that had happened before had happened and it was being honored, but at the same time, they were going to, say, okay, we respect that, we honor that. Now we're going to set that aside and we're going to take things in a different way, but you still have that like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. All of that is still, it's still out there somewhere else. There's still that idea.
Absolutely.
That it's this, parallel, timeline that at some point, if they wanted to, it's Star Trek. So something blows up and someone could find themselves walking on Deep Space Nine going, where the heck am I? It's just kind of that type of thing where, They honored it, which I'd never expect to see whenever I see one of these, remakes, reinterpretations, reimaginings happen. to something that's big and popular like that.
Yeah, because they did it so well, I remember shortly after it was a huge success was when people started talking about the guys that own the Buffy franchise wanting to do a reboot, and I was like, oh man, the Star Trek guys have just opened up the gates of hell.
Well, because
now everybody else is going to think they can do the same thing, and I'm going to remain completely skeptical because I feel like what they did was lightning in a bottle.
Well, and also because, you know, Buffy is such an ancient franchise. You know, I mean, I think it's one thing that you take Star Trek. Star Trek itself has had so many, I don't know what you'd call it over the years, but, you know, they went from the TV show to the first movie. And there was a massive change that happened. The technology looked different. The Klingons looked different. You know, they had all those kinds of things. And then, you know, when you went to Next Generation, you know, it shifted again. And you know, but you take something like Buffy, it was a movie and then a TV series, but it's not like it has this deep, rich history that they're going to, you know, kind of build upon and work from. And it's something that just happened. Like, as far as, you know, pop culture, generational things, it's still, you know, still there. It still happened. People are still buying the DVDs. Yeah. They're still watching the show. You know, it's not like something that kind of went away that, you know, they're trying to bring back. But that's just kind of how I felt about some of that.
Yeah, it's interesting you said that about Star Trek. You're right. It is like the idea of evolution and reinterpreting the series is kind of built into what Star Trek is, because it has gone through so many different derivations and changes, whereas like something like Star Wars, it's always still Star Wars. Maybe it's not actually. Never mind, I'm totally misspoke there.
Well, no, but I can kind of see your point, because, you know, the idea was the episodes 4, 5, and 6 were kind of the empire has kind of fallen and things are dirty and, you know, 1, 2, and 3 is all that technology is new and fresh and everything's clean. And that was kind of the idea. But it still felt like the same, you know, you saw a set and that felt like the same set. Whereas you watched Star Trek the Motion Picture, and then you watch Star Trek II The Wrath of Khan, that Enterprise doesn't feel like it's the same Enterprise from movie A to movie B. You know, the set is different, the ship is different, the lighting is different, the costumes are different, and that's just something that Star Trek, you know, even when they did Enterprise, which was a step back in time, you know, it was, and still not my favorite show, but they still made the technology, you know, fit a step forward as opposed to taking a step back and making it look like, you know, the original series or pre-original series.
Right. Yeah.
So that's just something that they do that, it's just kind of interesting how that finally, you know, worked out, because as long as you respect the source material, I think people are willing to just kind of go along with, you know, little changes here and there.
Yeah, totally.
All right. Well, let's go back to the comic for a minute, if we can.
yes, please.
The artist, I do not know how to say his last name. Do you know how to pronounce it?
Everybody has been asking me this, and I should, like, double check with him, because suddenly I'm, like, proclaiming to the entire world how to pronounce his name, and I don't actually know. But I think it's Duce, Christian Duce.
Duce, okay.
I should really find out.
Well, because in my mind, I've been saying Deuce in my mind. Every time I see it written down, I just think Deuce. And, you know, I think there's a couple other ways you can pronounce it that don't come across quite as nice. But did you have a lot of conversation with him?
No, not at first. More as it went along. But basically, when the first pencils came in, he pretty much started. I had contact with DC editorial, and he had contact with DC editorial, but we had never spoken. And so all his character designs and pretty much the first two issues, happened with us never interacting except for the script. And then since then, we've been collaborating a little more, and, you know, he'd have a question about, you know, something, an image I had described or, you know, something. And since then, we've definitely gotten to know each other a lot better, and it's been a wonderful experience to work with him.
Have you met him in person?
No, he lives in Uruguay.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But hopefully one day.
Now, when some of these, you know, scenes later on in the book, after they go to the Slave Traders Guild and they're dealing with kind of that, I don't know what you'd call it, like the red light district of Rome, perhaps there's the couple pages there where he's got a lot of scantily clad women and they're in these seductive poses. And was that one of those things where when you see this kind of stuff come through, you just kind of get giddy at the idea of what you're getting away with here in the comic and some of the stuff that you're able to bring across to the readers?
Are you talking about boobs?
Well, I was trying not to say that, but I've been told that Wildstorm. Wildstorm is owned by DC Comics, and DC has very much this kind of family-friendly front to it, this kind of all-ages front to it. And then they have the Vertigo line, which is, you know, it's a different editorial. It's a different group of people. And then Wildstorm, they also treat – because Wildstorm started as a different company and then was folded into DC. So it has its own editorial and its own people. And so, you know, depending on where you're at, you can get away with different things that you don't really get away with when you traditionally think, oh, I'm working for DC. So.
Right. Well, I probably am not as grateful as I should be in that respect. I mean, I do remember the page you're talking about, and when it came in, I was very excited and pleased. I mean, it's not like I told him, like, let's have cleavage in the shot. But, you know, when you're in a vampire brothel, you know, things are going to be crazy. But originally, we were under the impression we were doing a for mature readers book. And if you remember the page where, and actually some readers have been confused about this, unfortunately, which is a lesson learned, but there is a page where Valens goes to, and he drinks the blood of a goat he buys. And he has this fantasy of basically drinking Octavia's blood and doing bad things with her body thereafter.
Uh-huh.
And originally, actually, she was completely nude, and it was extremely risque. And then we learned, oh, no, this is – we need to scale back. This is not a for mature reader's book, so okay. But even so, you know, she's got, like, you know, some cloth draped over.
Yeah, it's very minimal coverage.
Yeah. But anyway, I still have that original picture, which is kind of a nice little memento of, you know, a thing that never was, just a little B-side of Ides of Blood, so to speak. But yeah, you know, it's they knew, like, this is a comic about vampires in Rome, and I mean, the intention was not to be exploitative, but it's just
that was Rome.
I mean, part of the genre.
Yeah, I mean, Rome was very hedonistic. You just can't really escape that idea.
Exactly.
Another thing that you went with when telling the story was the idea that vampires, they have different bloodlines, like different clans almost, I guess you could say. And so some turn into the bats, some turn into the wolves. Are we going to see another bloodline that turns into the rats later on? I mean, how – is this something – did you, like, do a lot of, you know, background into these different – clans and these different bloodlines, or is that something that's just kind of here in the last page so that you can have a wolf chasing a bat?
Well, I mean, the shape-shifting thing has always been a part of the vampire mythology, and I always thought it was a little strange for them to turn into physically different beings. And so I just wanted to, you know, do something where they could turn into, you know, just put a little twist on it by, okay, they don't turn into flesh and blood, different aspects. They become shadow. But also, you know, the classic thing is the bat. But when I was doing some research into Dacia, I found that their culture is really more based on wolves. And I didn't want to do a werewolf thing because that's like too obvious. Let's do vampires and they're fighting werewolves. Everybody does that.
Right.
But, you know, if I could say that they're both just derivations of the bloodline, I thought that would be just a nice way to kind of have my cake and eat it too. And there's going to be, yeah, there's, I'm sure there are many other bloodlines. We only see two others in the series. One is another common bloodline, and one is a more special bloodline. So, that pretty much is where that came from.
Well, we are all out of time for today, but I want to thank my guest, Stuart Paul, for being on the show. And everybody, don't forget, Ides of Blood number one already hit stands, but you can get it from most good comic shops. And issue number two should be hitting stands next week on September 15th. So keep your eyes peeled for it, guys. And again, thanks for listening. As always, I'm your host, Dirt. This is ineedcomics.com, part of the Pop Culture Network.